Well, welcome back, everybody, to Take Me to Your Reader, discussing adapted science fiction at its best and worst. I'm Seth.
I'm James.
And I'm Colin.
And we're once again going to be talking about a sort of long, arty, boring science fiction movie. and as you can hear, we have our regular guest for those kinds of movies, Ben DiBono from the Sci-Fi Christian. Hey, Ben.
I'm always hello. Thank you for having me. Thank you for letting me invite myself again.
Oh, you're welcome.
Has become my tradition.
Yep.
Always happy to help with the arty, boring sci-fi movies. They're my forte.
I like the way you managed to invite yourself on to the next one during the one that we're recording, right? So like last time you're like, well, just wait until you do Solaris.
And I've already got a plan for the next one I'm going to invite myself to.
Excellent.
So we'll tease that for the end.
Okay.
So. I figure he's got some secret connection to Russ Rep at OMSI, and he's like feeding, okay, next year we're going to get these guys to watch this movie. And Russ Rep is the vice president of marketing at OMSI, who is in charge of setting up all this, the film festival and everything.
Very nice. No, I was creeping on the film festival website. I'm jealous of you guys. That looked like a blast.
Oh, you're welcome to come out. We have lots of great places to run and bicycle and drink beer.
There you go.
Yeah, James will show you all the good beer places.
Sure. I like it.
It's been a good set, I think, this season. Film festival year.
Oh, yeah. So far, yeah.
I every year I look at the list and I'm like, dang it, I want Sunshine to be on there because I've never seen it in the theater. I do want to make sure to thank Joe Smith, who had reached out to us a few weeks ago and said, hey, I wonder if you guys would ever consider doing Solaris. And I was like, well, as it happens, it's on the list this year at OMSI. And so we decided to do it for either April or May, and it turned out to be late April. So, yeah.
So I know you guys watched the Tarkovsky Solaris. Did mm-hmm. anybody watch the other adaptations?
I did. I watched one of them.
Yes.
The Soderbergh one.
The Soderbergh, yeah.
Yeah, we all watched the Soderbergh one. We all watched the Tarkovsky one. And then I watched some of the first adaptation. I didn't realize it was the first one. Otherwise, I probably would have said we should do that.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah, and there is a fourth adaptation we can talk about at some point.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
impossible to see.
Mm-hmm.
It's not available, but it's an interesting story behind that one.
Hmm. Huh.
You have the year for this book?
61.
All right. So, anyhow, did I even say we were doing Solaris?
Only in passing.
I think we got it in there somewhere.
Yeah. So, we're doing Excellent. The 1961 yeah. book Solaris.
Yes.
By Stanislav Lem.
Yes. Which was adapted famously by Tarkovsky in 1972, and then adapted by Steven Soderbergh in 2002. And then there's also some other adaptations, and we'll talk a little bit about that as well. The book, Ben, did you reread the book, or have you?
I did.
Okay.
I did. Yep, I've read the book 3 or 4 times now, and I read it again this last couple of weeks as we were prepping for this.
Okay. So that's where we usually start. I mean, we start with history, with the material, right? And you said you'd read Solaris before.
Yeah, my introduction was the Soderbergh movie back when it came out in theaters. I remember going to see it with my dad. Really liked it.
Okay.
Liked it less now this time. And then read the book. Yeah. Well, and I'm such a big fan of the Tarkovsky version.
Mm-hmm.
Which I didn't see till many years later. I think the Soderbergh is 2002, and I probably saw Tarkovsky about 11, 12 years ago. I've got my Blu-ray here of it. So,
oh, yeah. Oh,
huge fan of that.
Is that part of the Criterion collection?
It is. It was actually one of my first Criterions I ever bought was nice. This one.
Sweet. James, you hadn't read the book before?
No.
And Colin?
I think the The first time I had heard about this film was from Ben when we did the Stalker podcast.
Okay.
And it sounded really cool.
I think, you know, so I re-listened to our previous episodes on 2001 and then Stalker. And I think you mentioned it in the first one because we were talking about the Through the Wormhole stuff and how long and drawn out that one is. You're like, well, wait until you get to Solaris.
Yeah.
Just driving on the freeway.
Yeah,
the freeway scene through Japan. Gosh.
Yeah, so for me, on... And just talking specifically about the book, I listened to the audiobook like 2024 at some point because I did an episode about translated science fiction as a genre, as a subgenre for one of my subgenre spotlights with Rachel Cordasco. And it was a great episode. We talked about translations from so many different languages, and it's really cool. And there's an initiative, the Translated Hugo Initiative, where people are trying to get more recognition for specifically nominating books that are in English for the first time. And yeah, that's pretty cool. But it didn't make a huge impression on me. And it was one of those things where certain audiobooks, if I'm listening to them to just kind of take them in, but not do a whole episode about, you know, because this was one book out of 15 we talked about.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I didn't read all of them, but the idea of that episode was to give recommendations for if people wanted to read more translated science fiction, where to start. And so, yeah, then this time I did sort of the whisper sync thing where I'd read it on my Kindle and then go mow the lawn and listen to it on Audible and then switch back. And every now and then I'd be like, you know what? I need to read that whole chapter in print or I'm going to re-listen to that whole chapter just to see what, if I missed anything, which I did.
Yeah, it's a fairly dense book. It's not very long, and I think it reads quickly, but it is, there's a lot of info dumps in it.
Yes, yeah. And it's, the publication history is interesting because it was, Stanislaw Lem is Polish, and then there was a French translation of it, and then the first English translation was based on that, right, James?
Yes.
Yeah, I think you were looking at it, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I got the book. Yeah, the book I have in print from the library was translated from French to English.
Yeah.
I don't remember what year that was. I think it's older, much older.
Yeah.
I think the English translation wasn't until like 2011 or something like that. I was reading on Wikipedia. Mm.
Well, and then even when there was a retranslation of it, I think it was kind of exclusively held. I don't know if it was Kindle or Audible or something, where I think it came out first on audio and then the print edition didn't come out. All that. It came out fairly recently in the last few years. And so I believe I listened to the updated version of it straight from Polish to English a couple of years ago.
I did check the version I read on the Kindle. It was the 2011 translation by Ken Johnston, I think. Sounds right.
Lem evidently was not a fan of the original translation.
He was not.
He's not a fan of much of the translation or adaptations of Solaris.
No, he's not.
It's a very funny comment on the Soderbergh version, which he admitted he didn't see, but it was, I don't recall my novel being about the erotic problems of people in outer space, which is...
yep.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the book. What is it about? Colin, you want to tackle that? Ben's read it a bunch of times. He could do it.
Yeah, Ben, you'd probably give it a more fair shake than I will. Because I did not read the book. I skipped a quarter to a third of it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the book and the Tarkovsky version, although Tarkovsky, of course, goes in very Tarkovsky directions with it. So if you've seen either that adaptation or read the book, they're fairly close. But you have a spaceship station outside of this planet Solaris that is, as we come to learn, is essentially a living organism in and of itself. It's a planet that is embodied by one organism, and that organism is Solaris. And humanity's been studying this thing for, gosh, I think around a century, give or take, at the time the novel takes place. And we're following Chris Kelvin, who is a psychiatrist who has shown up at Solaris to investigate things because weird stuff is happening. And the weird stuff in question is that the inhabitants of Solaris, the team of scientists, and there's three of them, including Kelvin.
Major spoilers incoming.
Oh, yeah, I don't know how. Do you want me to go ahead and say? I mean, it's like a 70-year-old book. We can spoil the darn thing. But there was a fourth scientist who committed suicide while Kelvin was en route. And what we find out is that all of them are being visited by people from their past. Kelvin is visited by his wife, who had committed suicide a decade previously. And so the planet is manifesting these visitors, guests, as different translations, adaptations call them. And it's really an exploration into what is going on with that and what does all of that mean. Now, Stanislaw Lem has always been insistent that he wanted it to be a scientific exploration of this. It's really about humanity encountering something that's beyond its ability to comprehend.
Yeah.
I do think he short sells the spiritual, psychological aspects of his book, which is what Tarkovsky's most interested in. He's critical of all the adaptations because they tend to lean more in that direction, especially the Soderbergh one goes heavy into, as he put it, the erotic problems of people in outer space. and I agree with that criticism, but I don't think that Tarkovsky thematically is as far off from the novel as Lem would like to claim.
Okay, that'll be interesting to talk about. Yeah, you mentioned it's a slim novel. You know, if you get it in paperback, it's a half inch thick, right? And 200 pages, 160 pages, depending on, you know, how big the the font is.
I think that the paperback I had was like 170.
Maybe. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But like Ben said earlier, it is kind of dense. And most of the time, it's just kind of going along. And there's a great creepiness to it when it first starts. Mm-hmm. And he first arrives on the station, right? He's guided, not even guided in, right? He's like, is there anybody at the stick? You know, am I going to crash right. into the station?
Yeah.
And he manages to arrive intact. But the first guy that he talks to is named Snout, at least in the updated translation. It was Snow in the earlier one. He's like, hey, dude, like, if you see anything, just like, don't do anything. Don't react.
Right. Snout's such a great character.
Yeah.
I love him.
Yeah.
He's so weird and off-putting and
yeah.
Oddly personable.
Yeah. And then, you know, like sometimes a creepy book is going to be like a slow burn. And while the book may be considered slow, stuff starts happening pretty much right away, right? He encounters the black lady in the station, right? Yes. Walking around the station. He's like, well, I didn't remember her on the manifest. And then he gets to his room and starts unpacking and, you know, cause Snout is like doing his creepy best and like, oh, just go take a shower, you know, get some rest. and really that's Snout putting him off long enough for his guest to manifest.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I love that first part where he's in his room and he's like, got this sense that there's somebody behind me. And so like he blocks his door and all that kind of stuff. And I really enjoyed that sort of buildup of the creepy part. And then all of a sudden there's his wife.
Yep.
What about you, James? Did you sort of first impressions of the book or?
Yeah,
and for the record, James had never read the book before watching the movie.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Yeah, so I feel like maybe the Tarkovsky movie might have biased me towards the book. Because I found the book, like Seth said, engaging right off the bat. And to me, it actually seems sort of like a detective novel at first. And like, you know, Kelvin gets there. He's trying to figure out what's going on the ship because Snout's not telling him anything. He's just, like you said, he's trying to get him to kill time until his guest arrives. Mm-hmm. So he can really like experience what's going on.
And I can't blame him either. Cause you know, he makes the point that like, if I had told you this, mm-hmm. you would have just put me in a rubber room. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Right. And so yeah, for me, the book, so yeah, like I said, it starts off quick. It goes, it's dense, but I thought it read fast.
I agree with that.
Until it like transitions to the parts where they're dumping all this data about solaristics and the mimoids and the asteroids or symmetroids and asteroids.
Try somethings.
All the different, when he starts going through the library content, that's when it kind of like slows down for me a bit. And then it picks
that's
back up.
That's definitely the trickiest part of the book.
Right.
Is mm-hmm. when he's, yeah.
But I like the way Lem did the transitions between everything. It did translate, it transitioned well between each part of the book for me. Hmm. Versus like the Tarkovsky movie. The movie, I'm like, what the hell's going on here? The transition was just not great. And I like the way the order.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm with you in what the hell's going on. And it sure is great. We'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah, so that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like I said, I like the translation. I like the order of things that happened in the book too. How we kind of look back onto solaristics and solar history from the point of view of Kelvin reading these historical writings.
Yeah, yeah, like it. The proceedings of
the
oversight councils and, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff where they talk about the gigantic baby in the ocean.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. It was interesting because I read the three-body problem and this – the reason that Solaris stands out to, or Solaris, the planet stands out and they're like, this is worth investigating is because it's in like a binary system. And they're it shouldn't be as stable as it is. Mm-hmm. And so they realize that like the ocean is somehow shifting to affect the orbit or something.
Right.
Which was interesting. And it hints at intelligence. So,
yeah, I feel like that part of the book got nerfed and it was not mentioned in the movie, any of the movie at all.
No, not at all.
No. No, the whole concept of the red sun, blue sun is probably the closest you get to that is when the gravity adjusts in the library scene in the Tarkovsky version. Mm-hmm. But, well, we'll talk about that scene when we get there because Tarkovsky uses that not to explore dual suns, but for his own purposes.
Yeah, and the Soderbergh one has the increased gravity thing as well toward the end.
Hmm. Yeah.
Hey, Colin, you did not like this book.
No, no. And to be honest, we just introduced the book. There is a whole lot more of the book that we didn't talk about.
Yeah.
One of which is the whole idea is the woman that Kelvin sees is not his wife and cannot be his wife because that creation comes from Kelvin's memories of his wife.
Right.
So you're one level removed from knowing what the actual person is. And we might as well still call her his wife because that's what everyone calls her.
Yeah.
She begins to realize this. She knows that she shouldn't be thinking and doing some of the things she do because they aren't right for her.
Yeah.
And she ends up trying to commit suicide.
Right.
And these life forms created by the planet are immortal. And so she can't die.
Yeah. I mean, that brings up another, I won't call it amusing thing, but like kind of builds on the creepiness and the kind of Battlestar Galactica remake, all this has happened before and will happen again thing where, you know, he pretty immediately is like, let's go on a rocket ride, honey.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, he so impulsively launches her in the rocket that he gets burned in his face. And then when he's thinking back, he's like, wait, Snout had what I thought was sunburn. But and then like he starts thinking, okay, I'm either going crazy or this is really happening. I have to be able to figure out how. And so he sets out to make these calculations and check them with the computer. And like, if we get the same answer or within a certain, you know, to a certain number of decimal places, then I'm sane and this is really happening. And then he does it and he's like, oh crap, I'm sane. And he puts them in this drawer and he finds a whole stack of papers for previous people doing the same work.
Yes.
Which I thought was really cool.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting things about the material in all its forms is that question of how much is this his wife and how isn't. And this is where, you know, I tend not to be reductionistic in my interpretations because you can go down the route. And I think Lem does, Soderbergh definitely does, of this is just a manifestation of his memories.
Yeah.
But I also think there's another side of it where you immerse yourself in that scenario. To what extent does that matter, especially given the circumstances of his loss of her? And that's a really fascinating question to explore. And that's where I think both the book and the Tarkovsky version do a much better job of exploring that and really drawing you into, I don't know if you call it a moral dilemma, certainly a spiritual dilemma of that type of realization.
Yeah.
I thought the Soderbergh did a better job of making Kelvin directly responsible and more willing to engage with his wife the second time around rather than the Tarkovsky, but that might just be a matter of opinion. So,
well, yeah, I've got strong opinions on Soderbergh's take on these characters.
Well, what else do you want to talk about the book? Because, you know, the big point that kind of comes in at the end is right. Like this just all demonstrates the futility of trying to communicate with something that's so different from you. And there's religious discussions, right? That Snout and Kelvin have about that as well.
Well, and that's one of Lem's biggest complaints about both adaptations is that they were all about the relationship versus this whole idea of you cannot help to communicate with something that alien to us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's embodied in the fact that they're interacting with the embodiment of the memories of their loved ones, some of their loved ones. Because if I remember right, everyone, they all were trying to hide their visitors from one another because they didn't want to know who that person was to them.
Right.
Except for Kelvin in the book, because he had brought the method for her to commit suicide, but was not directly responsible. Mm-hmm. At least in some readings, it kind of went back and forth. I think in the book, in the movie, it was like, oh yeah, I left these here and taught her all about them. And then she committed suicide with them. And then in Soderbergh, it was, oh my God, you aborted our child. I can't possibly be with you anymore. And she says, I can't be without you. And he says, you will not be. Mm-hmm. And then,
And then she literally does not be.
Yeah. And so there's a level of engagement in the loss of the wife that changes, I think, between the three stories.
Yeah.
For sure.
There was a good quote that I had here from Kelvin talking about the kind of futility of communicating and like the futility of the whole project. He says, they, you know, meaning like the people, the Solarisists and, mm-hmm. and everybody who wanted to continue the project, they said that even if contact isn't made, still by studying the plasma and all those crazy living cities that pop out of it for a single day and then disappear again, we'll learn the secrets of matter as if they didn't know they're fooling themselves. They're wandering around in a library of books written in an unknown language and just looking at the colors of the spines.
Wow. Yeah.
And I thought that was a really good thing. Let's talk a little bit about the end of the book. Like, what exactly happens? Because I had to reread it a couple times. I'm like, what? Especially in context of, because I, in my reread, I hadn't gotten to the end before I saw the Tarkovsky film.
Right.
And so, you know, at the end of the book, he's like, well, you know what? I've never set foot on this planet. And he takes off. And this is another thing, the difference between some of the adaptations is mm-hmm. the book seems to indicate that, like, it's like a hovering station that's just above the ocean.
Right.
Because
but it's atmospheric.
Yeah. Atmospheric, but low atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Right. And so he takes out a flitter or something and goes out and finds one of the Mimoid islands and right. lands on it and kind of has an epiphany about forgiving the planet for what it did to him, but also still hoping that she'll come back.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So the visitor stops showing up when they beam his memory gram encoding back down in high frequency X-rays.
Right.
Yeah. And then the physicist invents a way to completely disrupt the neutrino field, which stabilizes them.
Yeah.
Because in the past, if you managed to get rid of one of the visitors, they would just show up later with no memory of what had happened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But now this completely erases them and then they never come back.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And so you kind of have a recursion of her suicide, right?
Yeah.
And in this one, it makes a little more sense and, you know, not getting into theology of life kind of stuff, arguments at all, but where she kind of realizes, and this is where the book is definitely more clear than any of the adaptations, where she says, I think I'm an instrument of the planet studying you guys.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And there's that other notion that, the planet can clearly communicate if it wants to, and it clearly doesn't want to. if it can do these things, it could be more clear.
Could it?
There's another interesting quote, and it shows up in the adaptations, and I think it's early in the book, about a third of the way through, but I think it helps shine a little light on where Lem is going, especially at the end of the novel. So you'll recognize this from the adaptations probably. We don't need other worlds. We need mirrors. We don't know what to do with other worlds. One world is enough. Even there, we feel stifled. We desire to find our own idealized image. There's supposed to be globes, civilizations more perfect than ours. In other worlds, we expect to find the image of our own primitive past. Mm. It's fascinating to me for two reasons in the context of the novel and then other reasons in the context of the adaptations. For the novel, and I think it goes to why this novel has been so enduring, is that that's kind of a shot across the bow of science fiction in this era. If you think of science fiction, even great science fiction, it really is that. We go find an alien race, and they're kind of just like us. They just have another tentacle.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but they're basically humanoid, and they interact with us as humans. Or, you know, the Stugatsky brothers, who we did for Stalker, that's kind of a trope of them, is that you wind up in a hard to be a god. It's mm-hmm. another planet, but it's a medieval civilization type of thing. I think what Lem is going for in that quote is that if you truly met something alien, you would reach the limits of human ability to understand it, communicate it, all of that. And so where the novel stops is Chris Kelvin essentially hitting that limit and choosing to go beyond it. He's going to the planet. He's deciding to go beyond the limits of what humans with all scientific knowledge are capable of understanding. And what happens next is by definition ambiguous. It can't be written in a novel because to do that would be to ruin the effect.
Interesting.
Right.
Yeah. Talking about that, if you meet an alien, right, it's going to be just like us. I loved Project Hail Mary, but essentially Rocky in Project Hail Mary is just a five-limbed human in terms of his humor and ability to use language and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah,
it makes it easy to write a story about. This is much more of a challenge.
Well, it's the Star Wars cantina, yeah.
Right?
It's like, yeah, they all look weird, but they're there just having a drink and listening to some sweet jazz music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
There's some common point you can relate to as opposed to
yes.
like Solaris, which is supposed to be completely unrelatable. And if that's the case, then you can't communicate.
You know, early you mentioned about science fiction and translation and why it's such a cool thing to read. It strikes me as really strange that as science fiction fans who read stories about going to other planets and aliens, we read English.
Yeah.
You know, people don't go out and try and read about science fiction from other cultures. And so what chance would we really have of understanding an alien culture if it comes to Earth and wants to do something other than interbreed or steal our resources or do other things with us?
Yeah. Anal probes.
Yes.
Right.
No, it's an interesting book. I mean, it's one that I definitely got more out of it this time when I wasn't just trying to speed through it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. Big fan.
Have you read any other Lem?
I've read or listened to one other one. And I don't recall what the title of it is. It was good. It wasn't on the level of Solaris.
Yeah. Was it in the book where the Kelvin and Hari, were kind of make-believing that they were going to go back to Earth and talking about, what are we going to do?
Yes.
And then he made some comment about, of course, we can't just take you back to Earth. You need papers. And I'm like, oh boy, he was in the Eastern Bloc, wasn't he? Not that you don't need a social security number or that kind of stuff in the US, but, I don't know. These days you do get stopped and asked for your papers, but
no, think about it. I mean, if he had kept her belongings, her driver's license, her social security number,
right.
She could have, reintegrated with society in theory.
If she could have left. So,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Which the different movies answer that in different ways. So, or do they? I don't know. So, want to start moving on to adaptations?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
So, James, James, whatever your name. You on the call. What's your name?
He's our guest.
Ben. Yes. Yeah, dude.
Ben, I think you mentioned several adaptations. So, did you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Why don't we talk about the other two? So the Soderbergh and Tarkovsky will probably be most of the conversation. Yeah. So we'll start at the most recent one is a 2007 adaptation by the director Ryosuke Hamaguchi. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. It's a Japanese director. I don't know if you've seen the movie Drive My Car. It got a lot of Oscar buzz it came out a few years ago. Very good movie. Very, very good. He also has another movie I really like called Evil Does Not Exist. He directed this, he did an adaptation of Solaris in film school in 2007.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
And I tried hard to find it. I was ready to go to the dark web and track it down. It's not available anywhere. Like, there's no prints of it because they didn't have the rights to do it.
Okay.
Oh.
So basically, it's only been shown within the equivalent of the class. So as of now, it's impossible to watch. But he's a really interesting visual director, so I would love to see his take on the material. And then the Soviet adaptation, well, I guess the Tarkovsky one is a Soviet adaptation, but the first one, which I think was 65, that you can find on YouTube in glorious 380p. It does not look great.
Dang.
And it's a shame because it's actually a pretty good adaptation for what it is. It's zero budget. One interesting change in it is that it does not end with Kelvin going down to the planet because they had no budget to do anything outside of their three-room on the station. It is what it is. It's a Soviet television adaptation in the 60s. And so if you can watch it through that lens, it's a pretty solid take on the material. It stays very close to the book, except for when the budget would say, go do this. And they say, no, we cannot do that. But it's well acted and it captures it's kind of a just the facts adaptation. It's not, it's not going to blow you away, but I found it interesting to watch, at least as a fan of the material.
I watched a little bit of it just, kind of long enough to get a sense of how they were going to do it. And they did a lot of interior monologue, voiceover kind of stuff where, I'm going and hoping to meet my friend Gabarian, on the...
Yes.
And so thinking out loud my character and motivations. I didn't watch more than 20, 30 minutes of it.
And that's probably, if that was enough for you, that's enough. 1968 is when that one was done. So 4 years before Tarkovsky. I'd say if you don't love Solaris, don't worry about it. If you do love Solaris, it's worth the time to go check it out on YouTube, even though it is a little bit nausea inducing to watch it on a modern TV in that that format. I'd love to see it restored.
You know what we need is for you know, the movie Nosferatu, right?
Yeah.
We're lucky that it survived because it was supposed to, there was a order to destroy it all, right? So we need something like that with the other Hamaguchi.
Yeah, somebody smuggle it out. Yeah.
Okay, so
Tarkovsky.
Let's talk about Tarkovsky. And he's an interesting director. You know, this is not our first encounter with him. Yeah. And so there was some level of preparedness of, okay, gird your loins, boys, you know. and I, Ben, I asked you, because every time we've done one of these, I'm like, okay, I know you appreciate these movies, and so maybe give me some tips for what to look for. And you gave a couple general things for Solaris. Do you recall what those were?
You know, I think I told you just go with it. I think Tarkovsky, he's a director that speaks so much to the subconscious, you know, with if you try and figure out his choices, like what's he trying to say with this Japanese freeway montage? And that one might be a little, there is a fun, probably apocryphal story about that. I choose to believe it's true, where he said he did it to get rid of all the people who didn't have the attention span for his movie so that they get up and leave the theater.
Yes, I heard that too.
It's probably not true, but I choose to believe it because life is better if that is
true. During that scene, I kept looking at the road signs and stuff, and I was like, okay, is this China or is it Japan? And then at some point, I was like, nope, it's Japan. Because I saw some of the characters. I'm like, nope, those are not Chinese. Those are Japanese.
But, you know, the more you watch of Tarkovsky, you start to see very similar symbols coming up. Fire, water, horses are kind of his big three that show up in almost all of his movies. And you get those absolutely in abundance throughout here. What I love about the movie is that if you just let it work on you and you don't try and figure it out, you know, you just accept that I don't know what's going on and it's great.
That's two ifs there,
man. You know, we did a episode on this at the Sci-Fi Christian probably a year and a half ago or so. And I had a bunch of notes that I took while I was watching at that time. And what was fun this time is I had a bunch of new notes that are mostly different because it's a completely different experience every time I watch it for what's standing out to you and what's speaking to you. Of course, there's overlap. One of the things I felt was really interesting this time, and I've kind of played with this a little bit last time, but I was thinking about it more this time, is you can read the movie as cyclical. Meaning that where it ends and where it begins are identical. He's standing outside of his home.
Yeah.
And so that adds a, you mentioned like the Battlestar, all this has happened before, all this will happen again. That adds a really interesting interpretive layer to it. It's also, I think, a controlling theme in a lot of Tarkovsky's work. You see this in Stalker for sure, is nostalgia, not in the, you know, Disney adult kind of nostalgia, but in that kind of holy longing nostalgia, that desire for, you know, the C.S. Lewis quote of, if I desire something that nothing in this world can fulfill, I must conclude I'm made for another world. And I think that Tarkovsky really brings that out in his work. He has a movie called Nostalgia. So
there you go.
You know, shocking that he would delve into that here. And there's a lot of overlap to that as well. Seth, I know from reading, and I don't mean to jump right to the end. There's tons we can talk through in here and definitely things I want to come back to, but I know you said you were fascinated by the final shot. Are you familiar with what he's referencing there?
So we were talking about this on the disc golf course this week. One of my favorite classes that I took in college, it was an annoyance at the time, but looking back on it, I'm like, I'm really glad I took Survey of Art. Because I was like, that pose at the very end looks just like, and I thought it was Caravaggio, but it's Rembrandt's Return of the Prodigal
Rembrandt's.
Son.
Rembrandt's. Oh, you got it.
And I Googled it today and I was like, okay, I'm not the first person to have this idea. Somebody on Reddit posted an image from the movie and the painting and that it's unmistakable.
It's unmistakable. Yeah. And it's such a, the whole father figure who is not in the book at all adds such a fascinating element to this. I love the final shot as well. It's so eerie. It's so, what does that mean? I don't know what to do with it, but it's also so profound in what Tarkovsky's trying to draw out in this movie.
Yeah. And that is, you know, that's one thing that I enjoy about slow, weird science fiction movies is they often have something that I'll think about for years and be like, oh, hey, I wonder if this, you know, and it's fascinating. This movie starts, at least apparently, on Earth. I don't know after watching the movie anyone was ever on Earth. But they have, I think it was the main guy from Stalker who was Burton, right?
Yep. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Yep, he's Burton. Yeah, the guy from Andrei Rublev is Sartorius.
Okay.
Or whatever. So we have a few Tarkovsky regulars showing up.
And they're kind of watching like a film or something of his like testimony talking about solaristics, right? Like solaristics, stuff that had been seen on surveys.
Yeah, yeah. And
yep.
And that is straight from the book.
Yeah.
And so it was nice to see that in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, during that part, I was like, okay, this is going to be pretty straight up adaptation. And I think, you know, Ben, like you said, it does cover actually a lot of the book. It just takes some different emphases. And it took that part out of, you know, after he arrives on the station and is looking back, you know, at some of that and front loaded it there.
Warning, you're going to be creeped out.
Yeah. Yeah. There's weird stuff on this planet. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the key thematic difference is that if Lem is interested in exploring the truly alien, but still within the realm of creation, Tarkovsky's really interested in the planet as a stand-in for the spiritual, probably mainly God throughout it, but not exclusively God. And there's a couple of interesting lines of dialogue that draw this out. The first one is, I think it's Snout who says this, but everything we know about Solaris is negative. Well, that trips my theological brain, because when we talk about theology, especially theology proper, we talk about the via negativa, the negative way. Like, you can't, how do you describe God if God is a being who is beyond your comprehension? You describe what God is not. That's something Aquinas leans heavily into, but even more significant for Tarkovsky, being somebody from the East, that's a staple of Eastern Orthodox theology, is the via negativa. So that comes out. But then on the flip side, there's two really interesting references in the movie that also suggest a minor theme of the planet as the devil. And the first one is the reference to Luther throwing his inkpot.
Yes.
Which I've heard versions of the story where Luther was throwing his chamber pot, which I like better. but, you know, the narrative goes that Luther gets into an argument with the devil in the middle of the night and throws his ink pot or chamber pot or something at the devil. And then there's this stain in his cell for the rest of his time as a monk. And then there's also all the references to Faust throughout the movie. Right. And so you kind of have the major theme of God throughout, but then you also have this sort of satanic, maybe this is something evil, something untoward, and we don't know quite what to do with it coming through.
I have to admit that as I've been thinking about the book and the movie afterwards, it reminded me of Flatliners. Have you ever seen Kiefer Sutherland stacked cast from the late 80s, early 90s? Yeah. I saw it in the theater, I remember.
Oh, the guests remind you of the Flatliners?
The guests, yeah. Okay. Because you've seen the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they have like near-death experiences that triggers their sins to embody themselves and come after them. Mm. And that's kind of that takes more the devil route, right? On the, with the planet. Yeah. Like, what are the guests? Are they here to torture you?
Right.
Right. I love the library in the Tarkovsky movie, because as we talked about in the book, the library is info dump.
Right.
And Tarkovsky's like, I'm going to have a library and I'm only going to do Tarkovsky things with it. I mean, this library has no business on a space station.
It does not look like a library that would be on any kind of like scientific outpost.
No.
But it was a dope library though.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Like I want that library.
You've got artwork, you've got busts, you have guns, you have tribal masks. So the library, no, of course not. But the library, as I read it, rather than having a literal explanation, it is, because you have this whole theme of we have to penetrate through the limits of our scientific knowledge. Mm-hmm. Science can get you this far, but there's something beyond it. And I do think that's a theme both in the book and the movie. And so the library then is like, you penetrate to the heart of the ship and there's something else. There's something beyond science there. This is where we get the hunters in the snow scene, where we get a little art appreciation break in the middle of the movie.
yes, that was interesting.
Which I love. You also get, and I referenced this earlier, the gravity change, or as I would call it, the levitation scene. So levitation is a fascinating trope that shows up in at least three Tarkovsky movies. This one, The Sacrifice, and Mirror. Stalker has telekinesis, but it doesn't show up there that I recall.
Okay.
Levitation is fascinating because to understand the spiritual component of levitation, you have to approach it from either an Orthodox or a Catholic perspective, meaning that Protestantism doesn't have any like spiritual gifts. Even very charismatic Protestants don't have a tradition of levitation as a spiritual practice, but Orthodox and Catholics both do have saintly levitation occurring as a sign of deep communion with God. And so when Tarkovsky starts playing with that, and it's a trope that shows up, in The Sacrifice, it's very much done in the equivalent of being a reference to the Blessed Virgin. And here you get a little bit of that, but it's also towards the end of the movie, and it's brief, but it's beautiful. And it's also kind of fun because half the stuff isn't floating at all. So it's another one of right. these. Is it really happening? It's a deeply spiritual moment in the movie. And it's one I don't know entirely what it means. And I almost don't want to know. It's profoundly beautiful.
The other interesting thing about the library is the rest of the set looks like they showed up at like a factory and went, hey, can we film here? And the factory guys were like, sure, let us just clean it up for you. And they're like, no, don't worry about it. Because it was not a clean looking, like Arthur C. Clarke, 2001 looking space station.
No, and I think this happened in the Soderbergh as well. It was an indication of how much had been lost as these people stopped doing science and start engaging with their visitors and their others, right? It has completely stopped them from doing anything.
Yeah. Well, and there was all those things that looked like, tipping upright freezers and stuff in the hallways.
Yes. Yeah, don't know what's going on there.
required.
Obviously. Yeah.
I love the Don Quixote references too, and we get the whole quote about sleep from Don Quixote in the middle of the library. And Quixote is such an interesting reference point for this movie. I don't know. Has anybody read?
No, only I've seen the Man of La Mancha with Peter O'Toole.
Yeah, you get the base. Yeah. So the basic idea, of course, is it's another one of these, what's real and what's not. And to what extent does belief change reality? That would be at least one theme that could come out of the novel. And so Tarkovsky's playing with that as well. Everything in the library is just great.
I know, James, you had mentioned something about one of the actors, the dubbing, right?
Yeah, with the guy who played Kelvin. But I think prior to this movie, he was already a pretty famous Lithuanian actor.
Yeah.
But he has such a strong Lithuanian accent that for this particular movie, they dubbed him over for the Russian market.
Yeah,
there were two actors.
That's actually a pretty common practice in European movies.
Yeah,
if you watch any Italian movies from 50s, 60s, 70s, like even the spaghetti westerns, Fistful of Dollars, they're all dubbed. Mm-hmm. And part of that, like in the case of the spaghetti westerns, everybody would show up, and you'd have Clint Eastwood, and you have Italian guy, and you have German guy, and they're all just speaking their own language, and then they would dub over it. But if you ever watch an old Italian movie, the lips never match the dialogue. So you don't even try.
I just thought it was interesting that they did that for a Russian movie when I've assumed he was speaking in Russian, but I guess it makes sense after the fact if he's got such a strong accent and they want to soften it.
You got to think that the Soviet Union is so large too, that tried to have language superiority over all of it, but not everybody spoke exactly the same Russian. Made it pretty complicated too for after the Iron Curtain fell. There were places where if you spoke Russian, you'd get a beat down because you were a symbol of the oppressors. Mm-hmm. And so it was very, very quickly going back to whatever the mother tongue was in that region, in Ukraine or wherever.
I love the scene towards the end where he has the vision of his mother and we get the baptism. Mm. She washes the mud off of him. And that's really what it all ties into, the return to the father at the end, with the prodigal son. Mm. And it's another one of these moments where it's a vision, it's a dream, but he's essentially baptized there. It's pretty strong symbolism. And then the basin that she baptizes him with shows up in reality after he wakes up.
Hmm. I didn't remember that. Mm-mm. That's interesting.
See, that you got to go watch it again.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, okay, so I do need to briefly say, like it wasn't a super packed theater, right? There was a lady who was sitting behind us, and she's like, "I'm kind of excited to watch this. Anybody know how long it is?" And I'm like, 167 minutes. And she's like, "Oh, I'm out." And just left.
There were six people that left during the movie.
Yeah. Well, we went and saw 2001 a week ago or a couple weeks ago. And there was somebody who, there were people in our row who took off at the intermission, but there was also somebody snoring quite loudly I don't know, 2/3 of the way into the movie. I didn't fall asleep. I fell asleep during the 2002 one. And that was at like 11 a.m. 1 p.m. But that was lunch coma.
I took Ben's advice and just kind of zoned out for a bit there and just let it wash over
me.
Yeah. Well, at first I was getting really distracted by the subtitles and because I was trying to appreciate, like Ben said, the movie for the movie, watching it and seeing it. And when you have the subtitles still across the screen, I'm trying to read it at the same time. And I feel like it's so visually distracting for me.
Mm.
I don't generally like watching movies with subtitles for that reason, because I do find subtitles very visually distracting when I want to actually watch the movie.
It would be interesting in movies where like you really want to appreciate the visuals, dubbed might actually be better.
Yeah. So I generally like to go for dub for that reason.
Mm.
I keep saying it's really a 45-page book and a 25-minute YouTube video.
Right. Yeah.
Hard disagree.
No. And so what I've been trying to... I've been trying to cultivate a slightly more welcoming attitude toward these things that don't reach me personally. Like, I haven't studied art, and I don't do a lot of Russian movies, and I don't do a lot of art style films. And that's okay. They're for other people.
Sure.
Right? But it comes down to the point where when you have to tell me what's important about the movie, something has been lost.
Yeah.
And you, as a performing musician for a number of decades, as I've watched the decline in classical music and start to look at the beginnings of it and how they've lost their audience because they grew large enough that they began to make music for themselves, thinking the audience would come along with them, and they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Rock music came and took its place. That's what this art, an art movie epitomizes to me, right?
Interesting.
I'm not following along. I don't get the references. I'm not into the theology, philosophy, the art history. I don't get all the in cues and the out clues, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
I might as well be watching it undubbed with no subtitles.
right.
So.
Yeah. When we got out of the movie, Colin came down the stairs and was like, "All right, no more movies like this for the podcast."
Well, I have good news for you, Colin. There's no this and Stalker are the only Tarkovsky ones that were adaptations. So I can't suggest another Tarkovsky for this podcast, at least. This is actually a good point for me to invite myself on for the next one.
Okay.
Because here's what I think you should do.
All right.
Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, we already did it.
We did that.
Sorry, Ben, I didn't invite you.
Oh. Now, did you do the whole, because it has the book, but then there's also Failsafe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, so you got into all
that. We did the whole thing. I can't remember if we did two separate episodes. We may have, because, I had found out about the lawsuit between the books.
Yes.
I think we did do two different episodes. Yeah. And we tied them together with the lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the interesting thing with Failsafe is there was a live television version, a live teleplay. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you were aware of that, that has Clooney in it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and it was pretty good, actually. I liked it. But yeah, that was a lot of fun to do just because.
Well, then I'll pivot and invite myself for Clockwork Orange. Cause
there we go.
That would be
you might sub in for Colin on that one. So, I thought it was interesting that the main guy from Lithuania, his name was Donatas Banionis, which there used to be a Lithuanian basketball player for the Portland Trailblazers, Arvydas Sabonis. So it's a similar kind of sounding name. Even dubbed, I found his performance pretty compelling. It's quiet, and that's another thing I want to talk about, Ben. This is a quiet movie.
Yes.
Even when you expect. To say nothing of the fact that there was very little score, there was also very little ambient sound in a lot of places that you would expect to see it. And I don't know if this has significance because things like there's a fire and it's not crackling.
Yeah.
And so it's the kind of stuff that when I'm watching a weird slow science fiction movie, I think you mentioned this to me in the context of, or to us in 2001, is, you know, you kind of let your mind go someplace else and wonder, oh, now why is the fire not crackling?
Yes. Yeah. And it, I hadn't thought of that with the fire. That's an interesting thing. Tartakovsky does do one thing I observed this time is he does very interesting things with fire and water, where he'll have, maybe the best way to describe this, indoor things happen outdoors and outdoor things happen indoors. And you see that here, where at the beginning we've got the meal out on the patio and it's raining. And so, you know, the cups are filling up with water. And then later on in the vision, when they're on the planet, or not the vision, when he lands on the planet at the end, it's raining inside the house.
Right.
That's a very Tarkovsky thing to do as well.
Mm. The thing that I was missing is, and only people who grew up around snow, and are you originally from Minnesota? I know you live in
there. I am, yep.
So, you know, I've built a fire in the snow before, and the great thing is you get the crackle, but also the sizzle of the melting snow.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Oh, I also really enjoyed Natalia Bondarchuk, who played Hari. There's something uncanny about her.
She's great.
And like, because she's very still and very pretty. And there's just something about her presence that I thought was really interesting. And we'll talk about that in the 2002 one as well.
Yeah, the 2002 one is the opposite of that. They are not still. They are very loud.
They are, yeah.
I think there's it's one more step removed. You want to move on and start talking about 2002, or do you want to talk more about Tarkovsky?
Anything more about Tarkovsky, James? Or we could let, if Ben has a couple other notes he wants to give us.
Yeah, I'll give it up to Ben.
Oh, you know, I could talk for hours on it. Let me just scan through and I don't know if I have anything in my notes that's going to like have Colin fall to his knees, prodigal son style.
Well,
here for the moment.
Here's the question, Colin. When we went to 2001 a couple weeks ago, did you enjoy it more this time?
No.
Same thing. Okay.
All right.
I'll take my cue back, actually, because there is one thing that
I'm reclaiming my time. Sorry.
Reclaiming my time. That's correct. I like the order of things in the book better than I like the order of things in Tarkovsky. I don't like that it started off with the committee thing because it seemed to just drop us right in there with no context of what the heck was going on.
Mm. Okay.
I would have rather seen it as a look back like they did in the book.
Right, because they do have some amount of watching something on a screen.
Mm-hmm. And there's a few times where that happened where as I was reading it in the book, I'm like, oh yeah, I like how this is done in the book better. The transitions of certain things I liked better in the book.
Okay.
I wonder if you hadn't ever read the book.
Yeah.
If that would have been something that, because if you think about it, you know, I'm a psychologist. I'm going to the space station because things aren't going well. I want to talk to people that have been there before. Right. And this guy actually testified. So I'm going to bring him in and listen to his testimony and then talk to him about it and then go off to the space station. So that's how I kind of retconned it.
Mm-hmm.
It does make sense in terms of you know, just traditional storytelling, and that's what I thought was so interesting about it is I thought, oh wow, this is going to be a much more straightforward movie than I thought. Nope.
Au contraire.
It starts off being that way because that's the expectation. We're doing another alien intelligence.
Yeah.
We're going to go meet the aliens. Mm-hmm. But these aliens are so incredibly different that a 56-year-old guy in Oregon will not identify with the movie at all or have any idea what's going on. That's how different it's going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I do like how that expectation gets subverted. Yeah. And I like that that's a theme in the – well, across all three adaptations or more, I suppose.
I think
it makes me appreciate Lem.
Yeah, I think in the Soderbergh, because I watched an interview with him, and he says, in his essence, it's a love story.
Mm.
And I start reading all these things that Lem has written, saying, no, it is about our inability to communicate with aliens, and maybe more.
Yes. Yeah,
right.
And so, you know, Soderbergh is saying, from my vision, this is what it is, and that's what he did. And I think that works well for that kind of a movie. But when you look at Lem's work and Tarkovsky's work, there are other things of it. And if you think about this as an artistic movie where you are bringing your knowledge, I'm going to say extra canonical, right? As someone that didn't study art, I did not pick up on the art reference, right? Everybody brings something to this movie and takes something away from it. And that's the danger and the risk of an artistic movie is you might have shot for something. You cannot guarantee that everyone that sees it is going to get it.
Yeah.
And I think that brings us to Soderbergh.
Okay. Unless Ben has anything final to say.
No, let's hit Soderbergh.
Yeah. So this came out in 2002, did not do well at the box office. I remember seeing the trailer for it and thinking, what's that movie? And it's one of those ones where, like, you know, my wife doesn't have much of a tolerance for science fiction. So it was probably never a movie I was going to go to see. My son was about 9 months years old. My son was about a year old, right? It was not a time in my life where I was seeing a lot of movies. So I just didn't, it went right past me. One thing that I think is interesting is that the names in this movie are more similar to the original translation.
Right.
The bad one from French to English.
Yeah, yes. Where it's snow, yeah. Snow and rain.
Right.
And then they tossed out Sartorius altogether and went Gordon.
Yes.
But, and this is, you know, Jeremy Davies as Snow, like doing his Jeremy Davies-est performance of all time.
Yeah, that was awesome.
I kind of love it. Yeah, like, me too. He's a bright spot of the movie for me, for sure.
I would love to talk about his guest, because that is an amazing thing. All the other people had these guests that were ex-wives or children or midgets.
Right.
In the Tarkovsky. Snow's guest is him.
Right.
Yes, I'm glad you brought up the midget in Tarkovsky. That is an underrated comedy moment in a Tarkovsky movie. That he just runs out, gets picked up, put back in the door. Yeah. There's not a lot of laughs in Tarkovsky. That's a pretty great moment.
And so I'm wondering, could they not get a child artist to do that and had to use an adult midget? Or
who knows?
Who knows? It was Russia.
Yes, in Soviet Russia.
So, but here's the thing with the twist with Snow's guest in the Soderbergh one. It doesn't make any sense in the rules of the story. And that really drove me nuts this time. It's like, you know, you can go in different directions, but there is a rule that's well established in all these adaptations that the guests have to stay close to their host.
Right.
Right.
And that just doesn't work.
Well, or just like what the guests are, right? There seems to be some level of past regret and maybe he's just a narcissist. And so,
right.
I thought about a narcissist. I thought about a schizophrenic, someone with multiple dissociative personality.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where maybe there was one aspect of him and a second aspect of him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he had made like life altering changes to become a scientist to go to this trip. And so this is the old version of him. Right? Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I get it, Ben, that like it actually doesn't make any sense, but I still kind of love that twist. And, it recontextualized some of the things that he says, because at some point, Clooney as Chris, you know, says like, what the hell's going on here? You know? And, and he's like, well, I could tell you what's happening, but it wouldn't really tell you what's happening. And I thought, well, for one of the guests, like the guests never really give up much information because they're not there to help the people understand. They seem to be there more as instruments of the ocean or the planet, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a theory anyway.
A theory anyway, yeah. Viola Davis as Gordon, George Clooney as Chris, and then Natasha McElhone as Rhea. And she is kind of Uncanny Valley. She spent a lot of time looking directly into the camera. And there's something about her face that is just a little uncanny to me. Yeah, it is. I mean, she's very striking. But, you know, let's talk about the love story aspect of it. And I think, I can't remember what it was, the sexual escapades.
The erotic problems of people in outer space, yes.
Yeah, it definitely reframes things and makes it much more about the relationship. And
I feel like this movie veered more so than anything else being more about them. Clooney in particular, or Kelvin, I guess. Kelvin and Rhea?
Yeah. Rhea. Yeah. Which is an anagram of Hari.
Yes.
So,
oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with that in theory, because I think that, you know, great art, you can explore different parts of great stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a part of the story. My problem with it is that this couple is insufferable to listen to. Like, I was sitting there watching the movie. I rewatched it last night. And by about, you know, the middle of the flashback sequence that's setting up their relationship, I realized I hate both of these people. And they are having conversations no humans have ever had.
Right.
And it's like, oh, and you're laying in bed naked eating noodles. Well, you know, go to hell.
And talking about about childhood trauma. Yeah.
Exactly.
It wasn't crackers.
It just was so contrived. I remember it was a big deal when this movie came out that George Clooney's butt.
Yeah.
Like, that was a big selling point in this movie.
Well, there was male nudity versus scenes. Female nudity. Female nudity yes. was expected and exploitative. Male nudity was mm-hmm. sacred. It did not happen.
Yeah. Well, it's a PG-13 movie, too. So, like, that's the most they can get in there. It's, you know, 1.5 cheeks. So,
yeah. yes.
In shadow.
Yeah. It sort of reminded me of when he had his Batman movie, and his suit was the one that had nipples on it.
Right.
Yes.
And the ever-increasing codpiece size.
Yes.
Like, why?
Yeah. I read some production notes where when they filmed the sex scenes between Kelvin and Rhea, that it was in a closed set only with Soderbergh, and he was the guy behind the camera.
Oh, okay.
And
oh.
he wanted to do this so much that he was not only the writer and the director, but the cinematographer and one other role.
And intimacy coordinator, evidently.
Well, they didn't have intimacy coordinator.
No, that's a fairly recent thing.
Oh, and the editor. And the way that worked is he did the editor and cinematographer under pseudonyms.
Oh, really? Oh,
fascinating.
Interesting.
One-man show.
Yeah. So, you know, James Cameron had the rights to do this, and then Soderbergh heard about this and, you know, lobbied him. Hey, I really want to do this. Cameron was going to go off and do something else, so Soderbergh took it over. And he wanted Daniel Day-Lewis to come play the part of Kelvin, but Kelvin was doing Gangsters of New York, and Clooney kind of does the Soderbergh thing and says, hey, I think I can do this. I might be your guy. I've never done anything like it before.
Yeah. It's definitely on the artier side of Soderbergh, because he has some very accessible things, you know, like Logan Lucky,
right.
which is fantastic. And I think, did he do the other Ocean's films as well?
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah. Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 7-11.
Yes. 7 through 11.
Way different films.
Very different, yeah.
To me, it's the whole spectrum of Soderbergh, and that Soderbergh is such a frustrating director because he can be so great. And then so, I don't know what the language limit is on your podcast, but up his own ass. You
can that's perfectly fine.
Yes.
Okay.
Matt can bleep it when he posts it.
All right. That's fine. Sorry, Matt. It's, you know, and this movie kind of gets both sides of that. Like, I love artistic Soderbergh. Traffic is probably my favorite movie he's done. And I just love the visual language of that movie and the characters and all of that. And I love the visual language of this movie. I think the cinematography is gorgeous. I just think also, you know, the character piece is where he lost me. And I think he got more interested in being Soderbergh cute. And you see that again in the twist, rather than truly doing something compelling. I also think it's interesting. The opening shot of this movie is I will censor myself here, an FU to Tarkovsky.
Okay.
You've got the rain on the window there, which is such a Tarkovsky shot. Mm-hmm. And it's Soderbergh saying, because he made a big deal. This isn't a remake of the Tarkovsky movie. And then he starts with that shot. It's like, come on.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Okay, but what about the shot toward the end of the movie where Kelvin is scanning through the room and you see Rhea, 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 which is an exact imitation of a shot from Tarkovsky's movie.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, this is Soderbergh. Like, he said he made a big deal. This is a adaptation of the Lem novel and it's going to be closer to the novel. Wrong. Like, not
totally
even
wrong. Right.
Yeah. And so I think Soderbergh's playing fast and loose. That's a very Soderbergh thing, I feel, to say it's not a readaptation of Tarkovsky, which it's not.
But it's not a readaptation of Tarkovsky.
But it's not. But I'm also going to like come along and be very cheeky with it along the way.
I mean, that was a super cool shot when he did it in Tarkovsky. Mm-hmm. And I recognized it right away in the Soderbergh.
Yeah.
So
that was one interesting thing in the Tarkovsky movie that I meant to bring up. There's several times where the camera pans in a circle and then somebody reappears in a place that I didn't expect. Like I expected it to come to pan to the right and then the character to show up on the right, but they show up on the left after the complete circle. It was one of those things where I'm like, what are we saying with that? But
yeah, it's trippy.
Know. Yeah. Yeah.
It kind of gave me the impression that they weren't there in the first place. And then they moved into necessarily, but as they
shifting
were panning.
Reality.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the ending of this movie is, it reminds me a little bit of the ending of Annihilation, where you have two people with each other and they're not sure if they're real.
Right.
And I don't know if Annihilation borrowed from that. I'd have to ask Alex Garland, but.
He's local.
Is he?
Pretty sure.
Okay. Northwest.
Anyway. Oh, no. It's Jeff Vandermeer's local. My bad.
Okay. Yeah, he might not know because that movie did not take a whole lot of
Annihilation has a lot of Tarkovsky in it from Stalker. And so it wouldn't surprise me if some of those cues would be intentional.
Yeah, the zone and the shimmer area is I mentioned that on our last episode.
Yeah. I mean, I like this movie. I wish I loved it. There's just enough things that keep me at arm's length from it, ultimately. But I think that there's a lot it's worth watching. Mm-hmm. Better than its reputation.
One thing that I think that's often an interesting thing when there's a remake that gets overshadowed because it was a remake. Even if it's a readaptation, you know, it still is seen, you know, like if we want to parse words about if it's a remake or readaptation, everybody sees it as a remake because there was a previous film.
Right.
And so sometimes get unjustly maligned for that kind of stuff. I want to talk about the ending of the book versus the ending of the movies, because I'm not 100% convinced that Soderbergh wants you to think that the two guests made it back to Earth, but that they might be
I don't think they did.
Yeah, okay.
I think so bear with me here. Mm-hmm. I think all three endings are the same thematically. And the fact the slight variations are fine with me. Mm-hmm. There's just different interpretations, but same theme.
Okay.
I kind of disagree. I think all three have the same plot element of him going down to the planet and then reality shaping, but I think the themes are wildly different for all three. So the book, the theme I see there is, as we talked about, reaching the limits of human understanding, and then the next page would be the step beyond. Tarkovsky, it is the return to the Father. It's the return to God, the holy nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And with Soderbergh, it's the erotic problems of people in outer space, finally. Yeah.
I thought it was weird because it isn't Kelvin anymore.
Right.
It appears to be a guest. And so I'm wondering,
It's like the Slaughter's version of him.
Yeah. Has.
But whose memory is it?
Yeah. So one of the things they do is they beam his memory and Graham down into the ocean, which means after that, it stops sending guests. Mm-hmm. So it could make a version of Kelvin and have a version of Rhea or Harry and see them interact together to see to understand what's going on. You don't really need Kelvin anymore.
Okay. So you think they're still under the microscope?
I think versions of them are under the microscope.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid reading of the ending.
That's an interesting mirroring, though, because like the guests tend to be something pulled out of the mind of a human. And now all of a sudden, in this movie, it's pulled out of the mind of the ocean.
Right.
Based on the encephalograph.
Encephalograph.
Yeah. Nailed it first try.
Yeah, I think it kind of flips the whole situation and gives you more of an impression of the Solaris is actually studying them.
Yeah.
And while there's, you know, are arguably still studying Solaris, right? So
yeah,
there's a two-way road going there. And the, yeah.
No, it's, I mean, to me, it's fascinating just because I do like when there's a remake for them to be like, okay, let's make some decisions. And it's interesting to see the decisions that are made. I don't always like what they were, you know, or how they came out.
It was a choice.
Yeah. Choices were made. And I always applaud that.
Oh, for sure. And Soderbergh's done that. I haven't seen him, but I know he's done his own edits of both 2001 and Raiders of the Lost Ark. So he's not afraid to step out and say, here's a great movie that everyone loves. And I'm Steven Soderbergh and I'm going to do my version of it. You know, I guess it's part of his charm.
So, you know, for a guy that loves a redemption story, these are hard stories to read.
Yes.
Because I want to believe, right? He has another chance with his wife, but all his wife wants to do, according to his memories, is commit suicide.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And she's successful in it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a horrible sense of loss and grief. And
it seems like you should prefer the Tarkovsky one where it has the moment of catharsis with the father at the end. You just weren't clear on that story.
Yeah. Not identifying with that at all. I'm like, what happened to your wife?
I think the big takeaway tonight is Colin really needs to go watch the Tarkovsky one a couple more times to really take it in.
Yes.
Yep. Colin just grabbed the wastebasket and went.
I promise by the fifth viewing, it really clicks. You
love it. Actually, maybe what it is, you know, we tease James about it. And so I'm curious, did you drink while reading this book?
Yes.
And
it was a day that ended in Y.
How many drinks did it take?
Oh,
It wasn't a one sitting book, right?
Yeah. No, it wasn't a one sitting book. I didn't really have a problem reading the book, though.
Okay. Because there have been times when you wanted to drink it. I'm like,
mostly I have to do that to help me get through
this movie to take off that edge of, I don't know what's going on. I'm never going to know what's going on. I just need to be in the moment. And
yeah. Now, like I said, I think because reading the book, I got so much more context, so much more of the dialogue quicker and faster than in the movie. I just blew right through it. Actually, I was surprised how quickly the book went for me.
Ben, I got to tell you, I saw a meme the other day on Reddit. I think I sent it to these guys where it's showing From the Clockwork Orange with the eyeballs being propped open. And it said, me forcing myself to watch or to stay awake to watch Solaris and Stalker so I can prove what a cinephile I am. Yeah. And that fits.
I mean, there are slower movies out there. You know, here's one. It's an adaptation, too, but Bellatar, great Hungarian director. Satan Tango. It's 7 hours long.
Oh my God.
I remember you talking about this one.
The first 12 minutes are cows running around. I think it'd be right up Colin's alley.
I think I'd go with the cows.
So there you go. I'll invite myself back for Satan Tango.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yes.
Ben has called his shot. Okay. Excellent. Yeah. No, if we ever do get around to doing a Clockwork Orange, if Colin goes on a vacation or is in a coma for a while or something.
Any Kubrick. I mean, I just read, I'm a huge Barry Lyndon fan, and just read the novel. And that's a fascinating one because the novel, very different in tone from the movie.
Okay. Mm. All right. I think we're about wrapped. Should be, because it's really late for Ben. Sorry, Ben. Thanks for staying up.
Oh, it's all good. Yeah. It's all good. I'm a night owl.
All right. Rank them. Colin? Yeah.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought about ranking them. I'm probably going to say Soderbergh, Lem, Tarkovsky.
Okay. James?
I'm going to go with Lem, Tarkovsky, Soderbergh.
Okay. I have to admit, I don't think I liked either of the movies. the Tarkovsky one is more thought-provoking, just because there's a lot of time for thought. I think
I found the Tarkovsky one more interesting. And the Soderbergh just evolved to get rid of more of Lem's themes, and I was like, I would have liked to see more of Lem's themes in it. Yeah. If, as Soderbergh said, it was really going to be a readaptation, but it wasn't. It didn't do it for me.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I prefer the book, and then I go Tarkovsky, Soderbergh.
Well, I know you guys will be shocked.
Yeah,
so I'm gonna put Tarkovsky first, then Lem, Soderbergh. The Soviet version, the TV version, I'd put last. Though, if it ever gets a decent restoration, I'd love to revisit it and see if actually being able to watch it and not just a bunch of Russian blurs would improve my take on it.
Yeah, some of those old videos on YouTube, especially if there's a lot of light and dark. There was one that we did. The fungus one.
Matango.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So we're wrapped. We'll talk amongst ourselves and figure out what we're doing next. I think we're doing 12 Monkeys, right? We're doing a non-page to screen. We're doing a still image to screen. So.
La Jete.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. That's great.
But Ben, thanks for joining us. And where can people...
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, where can people find you?
Oh, you can find me at the Sci-Fi Christian, thescifichristian.com. We're also on patreon.com/thescifichristian. Lots of good stuff.
I enjoyed the episode where you announced your career change.
Yes.
Professional birder.
Yes. Yes. You know, and we did catch a couple of people with that. Yeah. We have a in real life friend who, for people who did hear, we did an April Fool's episode where I said I was quitting my job, moving across the country, and going to get my PhD in ornithology. And we had one friend who Matt and I both know in real life who was panicked that this was real and couldn't believe I was making this choice.
Yeah.
That made me happy.
Yeah, that was good stuff. Cool. All right. So, you know, let us know. Thanks, Joe, for sending us the note asking us to do the episode. We probably would have done it anyway, but it was nice to have somebody reach out at a very...
Yeah.
Fortuitous time, or
yeah, good time. I guess
serendipitous time. Yeah. All right. Till next time, may the road rise up to meet you, and may the book always fall open to where you left off. Cool. All right. Thanks, Ben. Awesome. This will go up.
Thank you. These are always fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben.
It'll go up in a couple days, and tell Matt to watch for a couple bleeps.
Will do. Appreciate it.
All right. See you, man.
Bye. Good night.
Have a good one. Bye.
Ciao. All right. Bye, everybody.